Marks and Spencer's. Marks and Spencer's, we had a failed state bike which didn't fit one of my sons. And we drove him to the Manchester city centre to Marks and Spencer's, which in those days, rather confusingly, was located in a different department store. This is because a little known Irish cultural organisation by the name of the IRA had driven a van full of explosives and parked outside Marks and Spencer's, demolishing most of the Manchester city centre. Anybody here know Manchester?
Yeah.
It's actually quite interesting because it looked better after it had blown up. But anyway, so there was in what was then Lewis's and now Primark, the basement was Marks and Spencer's, the ground floor was Lewis's, and then it was Marks and Spencer's, and then it was Lewis's, and so on and so forth. So because my wife had hurt her knee, I parked the car outside. She went out in the car, and I went to find a parking place, and I agreed to rendezvous with her down at the boys' department, which was the basement. I found a parking space almost immediately. I put the money in the meter, so I knew exactly when it was. It was 11 o'clock. And I went down to the basement to try to locate my wife, but she was not there. I found my wife again at 2 o'clock. Right? I parked the car at 11, and I found her at 2. And I don't know, well, this is a gender question here, and there's a book called Men Are From Mars, and women are from Venus. And what I'm about to tell you is certainly not politically correct, but there's a clear genetic distinction when it comes to men and women and department stores. In my own case, my tolerance for such places lasts for about 15 minutes. My wife, 3 weeks. Anyway, so there I was, trying to find my wife, and I thought, well, maybe she'd gone up to the ladies' department, so I'm sure she'll tell me. First floor, second, third floor. Remember, I went up the escalator. Of course, what I didn't realise when I'm going up, she's going down. And I got to the third floor, she wasn't there, and I just kept looking for her. And it was Hanukkah. It was the last night of Hanukkah. It was winter. It was cold. I had a big sort of like Parker type jacket. You know when you walk into these department stores and it gets huge hair dryer, clothes anyway, so I'm melting. Up and down, missing each other fabulously. I went back to the ladies' department for the 12th time. But this time I've become very friendly with some of the security guards. Marks and Spencer security guards, beating men. Anyway, so I was standing there looking at the maximum view of the department floor was over by the negligees, and one of the ladies came up to the attendants and said, "Can I help you, sir?" And I said, "Yes, I'm looking for my wife." Now, she must have misheard me. And thought I said I was looking for a wife, because she pointed to the negligees and she said, "You won't get one wearing one of these." And anyway, so I think it was about 2 o'clock. One of the security guards, Mark, remember that last, came to me and he said, "Rob, boy." I said, "Yes." He said, "We found your wife." "Where?" "She's in the basement at the boys' department at the leather bills." "Thank you." So I went down and I walked towards my wife, and she smiled at me, and I smiled at her. And we walked in perfect and serene silence back to the car. And then, on the way home, one of us said something. I can't remember exactly the words, but what followed after that was a little bit like, would have been if the USA and former USSR hadn't quite seen eye to eye and somebody had pressed the button. It was like thermonuclear explosions. Anyway, so I got home and my wife went into the kitchen to make donuts because it was last night of Hanukkah, and I went into the porch to prepare my Hanukkah. And who was coming up the path but a young man, a student, who we will call David. His real name is Mark, but we'll call him David. And this young man had been coming to see me for nearly a year. He'd been going out with a very, very sweet girl called Debbie. And Debbie, his problem was that he used to come and see me, I remember the first time he said that, "Well, so the problem was, Rob, that Debbie wants to get engaged. You know, but you see, I'm not finished my degree. My parents, you know, want me to finish my degree. I'll get a career before I think about getting engaged, but Debbie's very keen and I don't know what to do." So I said, "Well, look, Mark and David." Mark, said, look, I know you both very well, you're both nice couples, I have an IQ playing kids. I said, look, what's the problem here? Why don't you just get engaged? You're very well suited. Are you sure, Rob? I said, absolutely sure. Off you go. A week later, he'll be back. Rob, I don't know if I should get engaged. She said, because Debbie wants to get engaged, but she's my parents, they go crazy, don't they? And I mean, I've got to get a degree. And then my career, and I would reassure him, and again, he'd go, and he'd be back again. And who was coming up the pathway but Mark? I could have seen him on the TV, far enough. And he came into the porch, and pouring me oil, and I said, hello. I really got to talk to you. And I said, Mark, this is not a good time. She said, Robbo, I really got to talk to you. I said, Mark, what you have to understand is that into every life, a little rain must fall. And I've just had about 300 gallons poured down my head. It's really not a good talk. I said, Robbo, I've got to talk to you. I said, okay, Mark, just go into the room. I didn't have to tell him which room, he almost lived there. And he went into the room, and I came in and I said, what's the problem, Mark? And he said, well, I don't know if I should get it done. Now, actually, when you think about this, I don't know why he came. Because what he could have done was to send along a tape recorder with a little cassette which you prepared, you see, and I could have pressed the button and said, Ruffle, I'm calling all of it. And then I could have had my own tape recorder. I think you should. And they could have talked to Robin, probably eventually day to day. Anyway, so anybody here has ever done psychology or a counseling course will know that the absolutely essential ingredient when you're counseling somebody is to get them to realize themselves what the right path is, what decision they should make, and encourage them to come to the right conclusion. And so I turned around and said, you know, problem, I think really, Mark, the problem is with you, said, yes, that you're a complete whip, and why this girl picks up with you, I don't know. You're driving her crazy, you're driving me crazy, and if you had any decency, you'd let the girl go, and then get in touch with some marriage dating agency, and ask them to set you up with a giant fish, because that's exactly what you are. He said, do you think so? Yeah. I said, so you think I should get engaged?
Yeah.
Anyway, proposed. It's quite simple. How do we marry? Well, I mean, in Israel. I mean, you look at kids. But I want you to imagine. I want you to imagine that I could look into the future. And suppose my wife had said, I want to go to Marks and Spencer. And my ability to look in the future, I see myself fruitlessly going up and down the escalator, up and down the escalator, up and down the escalator. And would I have gone into Mark's
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then Mark would have been coming up the pathway. And he would have come in, and I would have said, what's the problem, Mark? I've told Don how poor she's got here. And I said, well, I think it still won't be married. Right. So looking into the future would be, it could be very dangerous. In fact, classically, in Judaism, looking into the future has caused all sorts of problems to all sorts of people. Do you remember the fight between something called Korach and Moshe Rabbeinu? Korach mounts a rebellion against Moshe. Why did he do it? Why did Korach fight against Moshe? Because he was a prophet? Because he could look into the future. Now when he looked into the future, what did he see? He saw his children sitting, teaching Torah in Jerusalem. It was obvious to him that he was going to win this fight, therefore. You can see his kids in the future, teaching Torah. And therefore, he carried on. He didn't realize his kids were going to side with Moshe. And that's why they would continue into the future. Or, if you remember the Torah story about the spies who get into... Can I see it? Look away. Here. Come on, be shy. Be shy. Or the spies that go into the land of Israel. And Moshe is told to choose the very, very best. And the very best come back with a terribly damning report of the land of Israel. Why? Because they were prophets and they could look into the future. Where they were in the desert, they were the leaders of the Jewish people. But when they looked into the future, what did they see? Other people replacing them, taking their role. Other people dealing with the Jewish people. And therefore they didn't want to lose their position, so they brought back a damning report. But why was it when they looked into the future they saw other people? Because they brought back a damning report, had they brought back a good report, then they would still be leading the Jewish people, or have been leading the Jewish people. So looking into the future is a very fraught and dangerous thing to do. And yet, if looking into the future is fraught, there is already, I don't know if you know this, There's already been invented a time machine. I actually usually carry one with me. I've got one to show you here tonight. And there it is. Somebody called the Chovos HaLevavos says with one of these, you can travel through time. If looking into the future is dangerous, but looking into the past, with one of these, that's what you can do. With one of these, you can touch the likes, the concerns, the worries, the ambitions of people who lived thousands of years ago and see exactly what their daily lives were like, what their experiences of life were like, why they didn't have mobile phones. And with one of these, it's a time machine. Okay? So says the Chovos HaLevavos. Looking into the past is much more secure. Looking into the future will be fraught with danger. Let me tell you, well, I was going to say a story, but in actual fact, three stories combined into one. And I think this will maybe be illustrative of this point. I remember a number of years ago, I received a phone call from a rabbi, a friend of mine, in fact, a Talmud of mine, who's then living in Manchester, now moved to Australia. And he said it was a lady who teaches in a Sem in Yerushalayim. And this lady was coming to Manchester. Could she speak to my students, one of my shirim, so she could, as it were, sell her seminary? I said, yes, no problem at all. Her name is Marcy Jablonovitz. And she teaches at a very, very good, or she taught at a very good seminary in Charmin. And so I agreed she could teach on a Tuesday night, having two shirim in South Manchester. She could have these slots. And on Tuesday morning, she phoned up. She said, I know I'm meeting you later on this afternoon, but I have a problem. I've discussed it with several rabbis in London, and they suggested that you would be able to solve the problem. Could I come and speak to you? I said, yes, no problem. So she turned up, and she explained the following problem. The seminary that she taught in is a seminary that deals with people who come from not religious backgrounds and want to catch up. She met a young lady there from the United States of America. This girl had become very close to her and grown religiously enormously through her, and then it came to the stage in her life where she was to meet somebody, second out and marry, and somebody suggested meeting a fellow who was actually a rabbi who had been married before in divorce, and the rumours surrounding the circumstance of the divorce were not terribly flattering to him. But she took advice from a couple of people who told her that, you know, nothing to worry about, the lion, or rather the leopard, changed its spots. And so with that assurance, she went on to marry this man. Sadly, the leopard had not changed its spots. As appalling as his behaviour had been to his first wife, so it was to her. She had 2 years of absolutely dismal existence married to this person. Eventually got pregnant. After 9 months, she gave birth to a baby who was both severely physically and mentally handicapped. A year later, the baby died. And so what had happened was that she wanted to get out of Israel to have a break, and she decided to come to the UK. She asked this Rebbetzin, Marcy Jablonovitz, what did she think? She thought it was a good idea. And so she spent 2 weeks here in London, 2 weeks in Oxford, and then she disappeared. She disappeared to the very north of the British Isles, to a place called Findhorn. Yeah. So Findhorn is near Inverness. Mm-hmm. So if you can picture for yourself a map of Scotland, so you've got the horizontal north, and then the east coast, it comes down to that, and then out. Well, then that's up elbows Inverness, and you've got 2 hours along that coast, you come to a place called Findhorn. And there is a commune for people looking for spiritual growth and spiritual experiences. And that's where she ended up now living with an ex-Swiss policeman. So she told me this story and she said, what did I think she should do? And I said, well, it's really very obvious. You are her Rebbetzin, her mentor, her friend. As a young woman, she's in trouble. Go and get back again. So she looked at me and then she paused and she looked down and she looked up and she said, I thought you'd say no. I couldn't possibly go all the way to Findhorn unless I had a rabbi with me to back me up. Subtle. So I said, well, I said, now, from Manchester to drive to Findhorn would be about 14 hours drive. 14 hours. It's a little highland road, very, very complex and difficult to get to. It was difficult for me to get away, difficult for her to delay her return back to her family in Yerushalayim. Wasn't good to work for either of us, and so she went down, and I picked her up, turned down, spoke to my students, gave two shirim. I took her back, I was dropping her outside the house she was staying, of this friend of mine, Rabbi Kennard, and I said, tell me the story again. you never know, I might, you know, someday get there. And so she told me the story again. I said, this rabbi, she was married to this fellow, sex husband, what was he like? She said, well, if you don't mind me saying so, you remind me a lot of him. I said, I'd just like to establish the fact that I'm actually a good husband. She said, no, you look like him. He's tall like you. He's thin-ish like you. He's a red beard like you. And I heard that, I thought, phew, I'm off to them, because it'd been eating me up and annoying me that I hadn't gone. We hadn't gone to try and help this girl up there in Invernessshire. But when I heard that I looked like the ex-husband, I was the worst possible rabbi who would turn up. What do you need is a small rabbi? What, a big boy with a long black beard who's going to say, like this, yeah, what the heck is a man doing in a place like this? Going! Right. And so that was that. She went back to Yerushalayim, and the year went on. And then I was in Gibraltar during the summer, saying Shiurim in Gibraltar, and it was Tisha B'Av. Now, Tisha B'Av, as you all know, is the most serious day in Jewish history, the anniversary of the destruction of the first temple and the second temple. All the greatest disasters in Jewish history tend to cluster around Tisha B'Av. The first European country to expel its Jews did so in Tisha B'Av. Which country was that?
Spain.
England. Spain also expelled its Jews on Tisha B'Av, as did Portugal. But England was actually the first country to expel Jews. Not Scotland, notice. We wouldn't let them in the first place. But indeed, if the historians will tell you that the Second World War is only the First World War Part 2, and the First World War started in Tisha B'Av. So it's a very serious day. And the chief rabbi of Gibraltar is an old friend of mine. We went to Yeshiva together. He gave me the great honour of addressing the entire community on Tisha B'Av. And they all turned out. I gave my shiur. Halfway through the shiur, the door opened, and in came a young man. And I saw him out the corner of my eye and recognised him as one of my ex-university students. And so as he walked past me, I gave him a little nod, and he nodded back, and he sat down. And afterwards, I said, what are you doing here? So he and a friend of his, he said, we were travelling around Spain during the summer holiday, and they knew it was Tisha B'Av. They wanted to come to a place where we could commemorate Tisha B'Av properly. Of course, that was Gibraltar. His friend was apparently a student from Leeds, not one of my universities. And that was that. Of course, you remember Tisha B'Av, it's the custom for men not to wear talis and tefillin at chakras in the morning, only to wear in the afternoon. So we went to shul, and because Gibraltar is a Sephardi place, that means to say that almost everybody from the community, almost every male was there in the shul, the most beautiful shul in the world, and then called the Foots of Dad. And when I got there, I saw his friend. I could see his friend because he stood out like the proverbial sore thumb, because every man there was wearing talis and tefillin, except one fellow. So I went up to him and said, are you Graham's friend? And he said, yes. I said, the guy from Leeds. Yeah. I said, have you got tefillin with you? He said, no. I said, would you like to put on tefillin? And he said, yeah. Okay, so I took mine off and I handed him the tefillin. So now you can, as where it stand out so much. And he sort of looked at me like, I said, bar mitzvah. Last time you put them on. Okay. So you forgot how to put them on, so I put them on for him. He's quite happy. We got mitzvah. And afterwards I went back to retrieve my tefillin. He said, no, thanks very much. That was really very kind of you. I said, not at all. I said, but you know, one good turn deserves another. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, where are you living now? So he said, it's in Newcastle upon Tyne. I said, well, when are you back from Newcastle? However, if you dig out your tefillin, I'd like to put them on just one day a week. Just what? We do it one day a week. Why do you put them on a Friday? So he looked at me and went, he said, I know where you are. You're a Lubavitcher, he said. I said, no, I'm definitely not a Lubavitcher. And anyway, Lubavitcher, why don't you put them on 6 days a week? I'm giving you a discount. Nearly one day a week, right? The idea I thought, me, the Friday, because, you know, Newcastle's right next to the gate, said maybe you can feel a bit Jewish and get invited for Shabbos. Maybe got a little feeling. So he said, I'll think about it. That was done. Came back to the UK, it was time for the annual family holiday, and we always go to Scotland.
That's so beautiful, I think I'll say it again. Scotland. So we were there in the middle of Perthshire, which is right in the middle, literally the middle of Scotland. We were driving with the family one day, all packed into the back of the Volvo, always did, rather than Volvo, and smart cars these days. And so we're driving along, and we parked somewhere an hour north of where we were. I'm getting back into the car, and I said to my family, "I've got to go." I said, "Pardon?" "I've got to go." I said, "Where's it?" "Findhorn." "Not Findhorn." I said, "We're near, and as a Jewish girl." "I said, you do this all year round." I said, "I know, Sunday I'll be in trouble." Okay, so we drove another 4 hours. We arrived at Findhorn. And when we got to Findhorn, we drove in, and I don't know if you know, an idea. Everyone knows what it looks like. Picture a Israeli kibbutz. It looks a bit like that. So we drove to the centre, which was like the community centre, centre of the thing, and my kids were all desperate to get to the bathroom. They also piled out and rushed in there. And I went around, and there was a display in this community centre of the history of Findhorn. And so there was a picture on a board of a field, actually next to an RAF station, a field, and on the field was one caravan. A caravan. And explained that this community started when husband and wife came and parked the caravan in the middle of this field in the north of Scotland looking for spiritual growth. They didn't actually say that the husband and wife were married to two different people. They were looking for spiritual growth. And then, you know, 5 years later, there was two caravans there, and then eventually four caravans, and it grew and grew and grew. There was a post on the wall explaining that there was a picture of a lady on it from America. And she had come there to look for spiritual growth in the 1980s. And she'd been meditating and going out into the forest. And after 3 months meditating in the forest, she had been contacted by Frigela. Frigela is the spirit of life in all living things. And every day she'd been going out and talking to Frigela. And was speaking to her in the forest. There was another poster which said that there was going to be a lecture delivered that night on the amazing healing power of dolphins. I had a picture in my mind of an elderly couple there at Findhorn when one of the guys goes, and he falls down, clutching his heart. Somebody says, "Quick! Bring a dolphin!" They rush in for the dolphin, they rub the dolphin on the guy's chest, the guy dies, the dolphin dies, but couldn't you feel the love? In other words, Findhorn is for lunatics. Anyway, so the problem was, how am I going to locate this Jewish girl? Because to tell you the truth, the story had happened so long before that I'd completely forgotten her name. So I said to my wife and I, Sean, you know, where am I going to find her? I said, just go. And you'll get what's known as siyata shma, help from heaven. Pushed my yarmulke forward, pulled out the tzitzis, unfurled the bears, and off I headed. And I found actually a Jewish couple almost straight away. Elderly American Jews, I knew they were Jewish, because they took one look at me and went, I could find nobody. It turned out it was dinner time. And I thought, well, I'll just have to pluck up courage and walk straight into the middle of the dining hall. Walked into the dining hall, and when I went in there, there was a serving hatch, and there next to it was cards with the names of everybody who was members, it was 200 names who were there. So when they got their meal, they would stamp the card to make sure they only got one meal. So I thought, this is easy. I'll just look down the names, and then I'll see that Jewish name, and that will ring the bell, and I'll know who I'm looking for. So I started to look down for, you know, the list of names. One, two Jewish names, three, 10 Jewish names. 49 Jewish. 49. So I plucked up courage, I walked into the dining hall, this exact same phenomenon. All the non-Jews, the French, the Dutch, the Germans going, "Hello, bonjour Rabbi, bonjour!" All the Jews, "Pshum, under the table." So I walked about and I just couldn't find this girl. Time was getting dark, so a long drive back to where we're staying, in the Highlands. Went back into the car and I said, "I don't understand this. You know, we travelled all the way to try and find this girl, to try and help, and I thought we'd get a bit of siyata dishmana, help from heaven. Nothing." And I said something to my wife. She said, "Who knows, maybe the real reason we came here was to remind that elderly Jewish couple, that first Jewish couple, for a few seconds that they were Jewish." So, drove back to Manchester, a new universal term is about to start. I phoned the UGS office, and the lady that worked there in those days, South African lady, she said, "Oh, Ramawawa." She said, "I was going to phone you." I said, "Yeah." She said, "Yeah." She said, "Because I knew a young student who lives in Newcastle who studied at Leeds. Yeah. And during the summer holidays, he and a friend of his was travelling around Spain.
Yeah.
And it happened to be Tisha B'Av, so they decided to come over to Gibraltar to commemorate Tisha B'Av properly." She said, "And when they were there, he heard a talk by somebody called Rabbi Wahba Rubenstein."
Yeah.
And he was so impressed that he came back, he's been putting on to film and everything. We're going to Shul Shabbos, now he's working with his father to bring his father to Shul Shabbos too. And when I heard that, I was absolutely blown away. You realize this has absolutely nothing to do with me. It's not blown my trumpet. Because, you see, I didn't even know this boy was in the shul. I saw my ex-student come in. I didn't know that his friend was sitting in the shul somewhere. And the sort of share that I would give to university students, and the sort of share I would give to the Gibraltar community on the Tisha B'Av, was serious day of the year, two different share. There were no jokes. It was all very serious. It was very heartrending. But he was sitting, and he was listening. And there are two sorts of people. There are people who are looking for the answers to who and what we are out there, in places like Fintorn. And there are some people who are looking for the answers to who and what we are here. Let me read to you something that someone who's a friend of mine wrote in his first book. It's called Natan Sharansky. It's called Anatoly Sharansky. And in the preface to his book, he writes, "While my own focus was on Jewish immigration, I was also active on behalf of people from many national and religious groups whose rights were brutally violated by the Soviet regime, including Pentecostals, Catholics, Ukrainian and Crimean Tatars. The Helsinki Watch Group, which Sharansky set up, because the Soviet Union had signed a document that said that they would keep the human rights undertakings, which they never did. It's called the Helsinki Treaty, so they set up this watch group to point the fact that they didn't. Also produced documents about human rights violations in Soviet prisons and psychiatric hospitals. My interest in helping other people's was an important part of my own freedom, a freedom that became real to me only after I returned to my Jewish roots. Now listen to this. For the activist Jews of my generation, our movement represented the exact opposite of what our parents had gone through when they were young." Sharansky's parents were card-carrying members of the Communist Party. "What we saw had happened in their dreams, and we understood that the path to liberation could not be found in denying our own roots while pursuing universal goals. On the contrary, we had to deepen our commitment, because only he who understands his own identity and has already become a free person can work effectively for the human rights of others. In Israel, when I was writing this book, I came upon an image by the American writer Sidney Ozick that captures the idea perfectly. The shofar, the ram's horn, sounding the synagogue on High Holy Days, is narrow at one end and wide at the other. Nothing happens if you blow into the wide end, but if you blow into the narrow end, the call of the shofar rings loud and shrill." And while Sharansky is saying that being in touch with who, what, and what he was, the narrow Jewish identity, but would then expand out to enable him to touch other people. Some people are looking for the wide answer first, as his parents were, because communism, socialism, is a universalist philosophy. Everybody did the same, and it didn't work. You have to know who you are first and what you are first, and then you can help other people. And there's a beautiful essay, which I'm sure you've heard many times from many, many rabbis or many speakers, but I think it's worthwhile repeating. It's by America's perhaps greatest man of letters, Mark Twain. And it's about us. It says, "If the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous dim path of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He's as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion with the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's great list of names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his number. He's made a marvelous fight in this world, in all the ages, and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He can be vain of himself and be excused of it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rulers filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they're gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held a torch high for a time, but it burned out and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. the Jews saw them all, beat them all, and as Dawood he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Jews are time travelers. Jews have always been here. Jews have always had the same message, tailored for different times, tailored for different societies. But the only people who've always been here carrying the same message through time, carrying it through time, is you. And if you're standing on the end of the chuppah, if you're not at that stage yet, or if you have, you follow an unbroken link all the way back 3,500 years to Mount Sinai. Jews are time travelers. I remember I was once invited to speak at a fundraising dinner for Hillel House, actually, in Manchester, about 15 years ago. There's two speakers, myself and somebody called Viscount Tony Pandy. Viscount Tony Pandy, his real name is George Thomas, and he used to be the Speaker of the House of Commons here in London. He was a Labour peer, non-Jewish, and a great, great friend of the Jews. His friend, somebody called Sidney Hamburger, had asked him to come to speak at this event, even though he was a man approaching his 80s, dying of cancer, but and his beloved Jewish people needed his help and support, he came along. He spoke first, and he said things there which were so moving, it was hard to recall. He told the story of the first Jew he ever met. He was born in the little Welsh mining town of Tony Pandy, so he was elevated to the peerage. The name that he took, or rather the title he took, was Viscount Tony Pandy. And when he was in this village, there was one Jew living there, Mr. Isaacs. There's a show in Manchester called Stephen Court, and I wrote for their magazine recently. It turns out that the granddaughter of this man is a member of the show, so actually the story is actually keeps coming to life in my life. But anyway, so what happened was the one Jew living in Tony Pandy, Mr. Isaacs, got hold of this little boy, 8-year-old or 7-year-old little boy, Geordie Thomas, and he said that if he was to come into his house on a Friday night or on the Shabbos morning to light the coal fire, which was known as Shabbos Goy, a non-Jewish friend to help you out on Shabbos, then he would do this every week, he would get a thruppence. Remember the old thruppenny bits, the old interesting coin, which in those days, we're talking the 1920s, was an absolute fortune. And anyway, so he proudly came home to show his mother the first earnings, his first wage. She was a stern Methodist lady, and she was washing the dishes in the sink. And this little boy came and held up his thruppence proudly to show his mum. And she saw it at the corner of her eye, and she finished washing the dishes. She dried her hands, and she turned around and she said, "Where did you get that, boy?" "Is that the Jew, Mr. Isaacs? He gave it to me, ma'am. I have to get to his house on a Friday night, a Saturday morning, after light his coal fire. If I do that every week, I get a thruppence." "Take it back, boy." And Viscount Tony Pandy, telling the story, says he remembers the quivering lip that he had as a little boy and the lump in his throat. He's about to lose his fortune. "But, ma'am," he said, "I can have it." "Take it back, boy." "But, ma'am, it's mine." "Take it back. Don't take money from a man to help him serve his God." And so little Geordie Thomas had to go back to the Jew called Isaacs to explain that he's not allowed to keep the thruppence. And the Jew called Isaacs would hear nothing of it and marched the little boy back to the mother. And there started a big argument between the Jew and the religious Christian over what would be the fate of the thruppence. And a compromise was reached. He would be able to keep the thruppence on that occasion, but after that he would light the Jew's fire for free. And then Viscount Tony Pandy turned around to the Jewish audience and said, "Are you Jews? You've forgotten who you are. When we in this country were living in caves, you'd already built your golden temple in Jerusalem. When we in this country were wearing bearskins, you'd already written the book that would be the ethical and moral inspiration of mankind. Never be ashamed of being Jewish. You've forgotten who you are." I'll tell you a story that happened in Manchester at the university over a number of years ago. It was 1995. In 1995, we always have a reading of Megillah in the university on campus. And I don't know if you remember back to Erev Purim in 1995, but the entire Jewish world was plunged into despair because what happened was the first suicide bomber walked into Dizengoff Street into a group of children who were in fancy dress, who had for weeks and weeks been preparing the costume, and detonated his device, killing himself obviously, and slaughtering these little Jewish children. And the whole Jewish world was in great turmoil over this, and the question was, should we celebrate Purim the way that we normally celebrate? So one of my students went up and said, maybe we should cancel the reading of the Megillah on campus. One of his non-Jewish friends had said, how can you go ahead with your celebration, but this has happened. I said to him, no, under no circumstances we're not doing that. We go ahead. So the next day, I came into the room, which is about the same size here as this room. All the students were gathered there, but nobody was in a very good mood, and everybody felt a bit uncomfortable to be there. But normally I don't really dress up in Purim anymore, you get to a certain age, but I decided to go to fancy dress. Well, not only a fancy dress, I went to a costume race, and I got the costume, I think, which makes any man look, well, better than anything else you could think of wearing. I'm talking, of course, about the Highland kilt. I came into the room and all the students were there. I took off my coat and there was my kilt and my... magnificent. They all looked somewhat surprised. And we started to read Megillah, and the first time we mentioned Holland's name, of course, somebody banged the chest of people, but nobody was. But I didn't know. Bang! And shouting and screaming, and I took a name. And eventually a couple warmed up, and by the end of the reading of the Megillah, it was almost, like a normal Purim. And then one of the students said to me, why don't I say something? So I told them a true story. During the Second World War, the Nazis marched a group of Jews, one of the ghettos, into the forest. They corralled them into an area which was, you know, literally like a crown of barbed wire. And there was machine guns ready to mow them down. And the thugs with sticks started to beat the Jews back so they'd fall onto the barbed wire. One of the Jews stumbled, and as he did so, he tried to stop himself falling. It looked like a jig, and this gave the major in charge of this massacre a good idea. He called off his thugs and he said, dance, Jews, dance. Now, are you going to dance for the amusement of this sadistic thug? I mean, we knew they were going to be killed anyway. But this Jew starts to dance. He starts to dance, and he starts to sing a well-known Jewish melody, but he put new words to it. And he started to dance, and he sang, Mervil ze iberleven, iberleven, iberleven. Mervil ze iberleven, aminishe b'shemayim. We will outlive them, outlive them, outlive them. We will outlive them, our Father in heaven. And when the other Jews heard this, they started to dance too. And they started to sing the song, and the Nazis thought this was very, very funny, until they heard the words. Yiddish and German are almost identical anyway. And he's screaming at them to stop, and the machine guns opened up, and they were all killed except a few who managed to get through the barbed wire and run into the forest, and I'm able to bring the story to those students and to you. And I told them that something very interesting. If you look at the Megillah, and if you look at the Mishnah in the Megillah, and it talks about the reading of the Megillah, everybody knows that you read the Megillah on a certain day of Adar, Purim, when we're coming to it. Except, if you live in a city which was walled from the time of Yeshua's conquest of the land of Israel, then you read the Megillah the day next day, right? And the question which somebody called the Bar Tanura asks, one of the classic commentators, why did they fix the date on Joshua's conquest of the land of Israel? It would not make sense to say, if you live in a city that was walled from the time of Mordechai and Esther in the Purim story, then you should have it the next day. And this is what he says. When the Purim story took place, there were no Jews living in the land of Israel. Everybody had been expelled. Everyone had been thrown out. The houses were desolate and ruined. And all the Jews were living in this exile. The rabbi specifically wanted to give honor to the land of Israel and express their confidence that for one more time, once more, Jews would be living in the land of Israel. Once again, Jewish voices would be heard playing in the street, kids' voices playing in the streets of Yerushalayim, running and through the woods and the alleys of the land of Israel. That's why they fixed it. And when I finished saying this, I said, if we were going to cancel our celebrations because of a tragedy that happened on that date in Jewish history, we'd never have a festival. Our history is so long and so bloody and so terrible. There's always been some massacre sometime, but we never have any festival. I don't know why I started saying Am Yisrael Chai. And I started singing it, and all the students started to sing. They started singing and they started to dance. And we all danced out of that room and we danced onto the campus. There's a fellow who lives in London, who's one of my students at the time, called Dan Quint. And Dan Quint was giving his final presentation for his degree, And the degree was on human geography or something like that. And through an open window, up came the voices of Jewish students singing Am Yisrael Chai, Am Yisrael Chai. And there was these examiners, he's giving this presentation, and suddenly he stopped. He said, ladies and gentlemen, you can hear at the moment the voices of Jewish children singing the Hebrew words Am Yisrael Chai. It means the Jewish people will live. It's because today is the festival of Purim. And he explained the whole Purim story. He got a first. There is nobody like the Jewish people. We are time travellers. We've been in all the ages. We beat the Egyptian, and we beat the Babylonian, and we beat the Greek, and we beat the Roman, and we'll beat our enemies today. Because we travel through time, unchanging. Who we are is who we've always been. As my old friend, Viscount Tony Pandy, said, never be ashamed of being Jewish. You've forgotten who you are. Who you are time travellers. Thank you.